Our guest today is Michael Flynn, the founder and lead researcher of the Global Detention Project. The project includes the largest collection of information about migration-related detention available on the internet. Michael has written about border and migration issues in major newspapers in the U.S. and is also program manager for RightWeb, an online research and publishing project about foreign policy leaders pushing for militaristic foreign policy in the United States. The Global Detention Project is based at the Graduate Institute's Program for the Study of Global Migration in Geneva, Switzerland. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Lauren. Thanks for having me on the show.
To begin, can you tell us about migration-related detention and the Global Detention Project?
The project defines migration-related detention as the deprivation of liberty of non-citizens because of their undocumented or irregular status. So this is a pretty... This can include either irregular immigrants, undocumented immigrants, or, as they're called in the United States, illegal aliens. It can also include asylum seekers who are detained because they don't have appropriate papers or because certain countries have policies to detain asylum seekers until at least an initial review of their claims are made.
Mm-hmm.
It can also include people who are non-citizens with status in certain countries but lose that status for any number of reasons. For instance, having committed certain crimes in the United States, for example, you're subject to loss of status and can be detained until you can be deported.
Mm-hmm. And how did the Global Detention Project begin?
It began because as a reporter writing, as a journalist writing on immigration issues throughout the Americas for many years, one of my beats was looking at U.S. involvement in efforts to detain immigrants before they reach the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And what I increasingly found from country to country to country is that the United States was actively participating, collaborating with immigration and other law enforcement bodies in countries from Mexico to Ecuador in detaining and keeping immigrants from actually leaving the country or going through certain countries like Mexico. And one of the ways that they do this, for example, in Guatemala, I found the United States paying for Guatemala to have detention centers that would keep people detained in Guatemala until they could be sent back wherever they came from. In one case, they were a detention center paid for through the U.S. Embassy, was holding Indian migrants for months and months and months, and no one really knew what was going on, and we couldn't even get any details on it. It was extraordinarily frustrating to find out anything, because authorities don't typically like to talk about this issue. So for a long time, I had this frustration. If I wanted to find out about immigration detention, I had to dig and dig and dig. And so in the back of my mind, there had always been this idea that, well, this is a niche that needs to be filled.
Mm-hmm.
This is clearly a phenomenon that's global, but to call, from one country to the next, it can be very difficult to get any data. So that was sort of the origin in my head of this project. It began 3 years ago with a grant from a Geneva foundation,
mm-hmm.
a Geneva-based foundation, as a project, as a sort of limited project to look at the scope, detail the scope, develop a database that looks at a broad number of countries to see just how big this phenomena is.
Okay.
And it was sort of a collaboration between myself and the political science department at the Graduate Institute. So that's sort of the origins of it and the sort of reasons why it came about.
Excellent. And do you mind if I ask, who runs the detention centers in places like Guatemala and Ecuador that are heavily influenced by the U.S.? Are these run by the Guatemalan and Ecuadorian governments or private contractors or a mix?
It's an interesting question because, first of all, let me just be clear.
Mm-hmm.
In Ecuador, there is a detention issue. But in terms of the United States funding of detention centers, I couldn't tell you that that's actually happened in Ecuador. I don't have evidence of that. There's evidence of the United States detaining boats that leave Ecuador.
I see.
En route to the United States. But in Guatemala, I mean, this was something that was being paid for by the United States, but they were under the authority of Guatemala.
Okay.
Now, in some instances, you find that countries are paying other countries, not only paying them, but also running these detention centers. And Australia is a very famous case, or infamous
mm-hmm.
case of this,
mm-hmm.
of keeping migrants detained in other countries offshore, and they were running these places. So it's sort of a diverse, you can find all kinds of different ways in which this happens. Australia, by the way, no longer does this.
Mm-hmm.
They've closed those offshore detention sites, except for the one on Christmas Island. So,
Accepting that there's a wide variation between countries. What kinds of trends in migration-related detention have you and your team observed? Are we seeing detention in new places, the expansion of detention bed space in places that have always had migration-related detention? Can you tell us a little bit about what you all have found?
Well, I'd say that one of the interesting things that we found out, having looked at nearly 75 countries, is that every country we look at detains people because of their status. Some countries do it more than others, and some have increased the practice over in the recent years. So it's hard for me to be able to tell you that it's expanded to new places.
Okay.
I think that there's been a very strong pressure on countries, especially these countries we call transit states, countries through which immigrants travel to make it from their home country to another country. So Mexico, for example, is a good case in point. Although millions come from Mexico to the United States, it's also used as a staging ground or as a route through which immigrants from Latin America and across the world try to come into the United States through. And then in the European context, Libya, Morocco, Turkey, they're all sort of there's pressure on all these countries, the Ukraine, to increase their efforts to interdict, to detain these immigrants, detain migrants before they reach the borders of the European Union. So I think that you do see, I think if you were to be able to get the data, and it's very difficult to get it for a lot of these countries, you would clearly see a trend in more people being detained in these places. But it's not an easy thing to find out, actually, just historical data. Historically speaking, it can be very difficult.
Okay.
In terms of what you look at today, what kind of trends? I mean, there's a clear trend towards increasing detention capacities, especially in major industrialized countries that are the destinations for many immigrants. So, for instance, I mean, the United States in 1994 had space for about 7,000 immigration detainees.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's nearly 35,000.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
a tremendous increase. The UK, there's been also a similar increase in terms of this percentage growth. But you can also see this in other countries like South Africa. So there is a clear trend towards growing detention infrastructures, as it were.
Moving to the physical infrastructures of detention, what kinds of places are used for detention? Again, allowing for the wide variation between countries, but as you see expanding detention in places like the United States, but also transit countries like the Ukraine and Mexico, what kinds of spaces and places are used for detention?
I think that's one of the more interesting aspects one of the aspects of our work that makes it very difficult is just how diverse, how big of a range of places are used for this. In Europe, most detention sites, I mean, there's a gradual regime being put in place through European-wide regulations for who can be detained and under what circumstances and where. And so you have places that are dedicated migrant detention facilities. These are facilities that are used for only that purpose. That's sort of one type of facility. But if you go to the United States and Canada as well, there's a wide use of prisons, all kinds of prisons, whether they're federally run prisons or local jails. And in the United States, I mean, there's some 900 prisons on contract. I mean, as of 2007, that's the most recent comprehensive data I have in the United States. I don't think it's changed that much. About 900 jails and prisons and federal penitentiaries that are on contract with the federal government to hold migration detainees when or if it's necessary. In addition, you can sort of break down these categories. So, amongst the dedicated migrant detention centers, there's a wide range of possible types. So, you have, for example, deportation centers. These are migrant facilities that are used only to hold people who have been issued deportation orders, uniquely for that reason. There are also detention centers that are just for asylum seekers who are detained for a few days at these facilities as they await an initial assessment of their claims. And then you go into sort of stranger types of places. I mean, both Canada and the United States, there are cases of hotel rooms being used.
Mm-hmm.
when it's expedient, when there's no other place to hold these people. In South Africa, the police service uses a gym on a former military base on the border with Zimbabwe to hold hundreds and hundreds, maybe even thousands of detainees at a time. Mm-hmm. And this is just something that they used to be held in a sort of open, exposed camp, but there was pressure on them, so they put them in a former sports facility and built sort of a makeshift wall to separate the men from the women.
Okay.
These are sort of ad hoc places, we would call them,
okay,
because they're not officially designated as detention sites, yet this is probably the most common form of detention in the developing world. In Mauritania, mm-hmm, for example, where a lot of immigrants were leaving from different parts of Africa through Mauritania to get on boats to go to the Canary Islands,
mm-hmm,
the Spanish government, according to media reports, helped pay for the construction of a detention site, a transit center, and a former schoolhouse.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's a very diverse range of places. And so in our database, as we build this database, we've tried to be as specific as possible and try to differentiate between types, because the different types also has a lot to do with the legal status of these people.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, lots of different places, kinds of places.
What kinds of policy changes are making this possible? Are there new laws enabling the expansion of migration-related detention? New interpretations of older laws? Can you tell us a bit about what's been happening at the policy level, perhaps focusing on countries where you've seen the largest expansion in recent years?
Well, I think, there's a few things going on here. First, I mean, mm-hmm, since 9/11, there has been an effort to apply the law more strictly. If you were to go back and look at, say, any five countries and look at their laws, the laws on the books going back decades, going back to the foundations of some of these countries,
mm-hmm,
you'll see that it is against the law to be in the country without appropriate authorization. So that alone, it forms a sort of basis for detaining somebody, right? Now, in terms of what we look at today, so to be clear, I mean, this is not necessarily anything new, right? This has,
mm-hmm,
been around for a long time, this possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when we talk about the expanding nature of this phenomena, we have to look at a few things. I think one, the most recent issue is the 9/11 terror attacks and how that has been used to justify imposing laws already in the books. So, for instance, in the United States, there was an effort to detain lots of Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Who were suspected of having violated an immigration law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so these people weren't detained of any, or they weren't charged of any crime. They were held as basically terror suspects, but not really. It wasn't really. They didn't say it, but they went and they applied the law more strictly to one group of people. Right.
Okay.
So that was one form of it. In Canada, there was this issue of there was the whole issue of security certificates,
mm-hmm,
which I'm sure you're aware of. This is sort of a different phenomenon. I mean, so what did Canada do? So they had the law was made, the IRPA was made in 2001, and then it was adapted, in 2003, to issue these security certificates.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was what was this all about? This wasn't detaining people on migration-related grounds, right? It was saying that, oh, they may be a security threat to this country. We need to detain them. They're non-citizens, and that enabled them to be given one of these certificates, but they weren't being detained because of their status per se, right?
Okay.
So they created a whole center, the Kingston Immigration Detention Center in Kingston,
mm-hmm,
Ontario, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that, interestingly enough, is not a center that actually falls under the purview of the detention project because it's not migration-related detention per se.
Okay.
So 9/11, clearly there is an effort. There, laws that are already in the books are being applied more strictly. On another level, going back several years, I think it's part of a sort of hysteria to some degree about concerns about increasing numbers of immigrants, both in the United States and also in Europe, in Australia. You saw an effort to remove certain non-citizens who were convicted of crimes.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, you know, the so-called criminal aliens.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, this is the most pronounced reason for why immigration detention has gone up so much, I
mm-hmm.
think. I mean, this law, expedited removal, passed during the Clinton administration, I think in 1996,
mm-hmm.
it said that if you've committed certain crimes and you go to jail, you then lose your status, and then when you finished your prison term, we keep you in detention. We keep you until we can deport you.
Mm-hmm.
You go from the custody of the prison service to the custody of immigration, and then immigration holds you indefinitely until they can get rid of you.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a really big issue, and a similar thing. The UK also has a serious issue with this. What drives detention, what increasing numbers, is this issue of detaining people who have committed certain crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it becomes more complicated when the home countries of these so-called criminal aliens
mm-hmm.
refuse to take these people because they're criminals,
mm-hmm.
right? Even if they've
mm-hmm.
already served time, they're not marked, right? And so Haiti, for example, recently started refusing to take these criminal aliens, and so these people languish in detention. But this is actually a broader issue on the policy level, or at least on the level of practice, on what countries choose to do. I mean, Africa, for instance, has made it increasingly difficult for European countries to deport their nationals back to them.
Okay.
So it's a complex of both the recipient state and the sending state policies that help drive, that have helped drive this issue in recent years.
Could you talk a little bit about what kinds of crimes make a non-citizen eligible for losing their status and then entering the immigration detention system and the deportation system?
I don't want to talk too much. I don't want to say too much on the record because I'm not an expert in this.
Okay.
In terms of what actually, I know that in the United States, felony crimes,
mm-hmm.
but also I know that the law says an additional set of crimes. It's not very specific.
Okay.
So I know that it's a pretty broad range of things that you can do that can cause you to lose your status, and it doesn't have to reach the level of being a felony crime.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how, for example, in Canada, having a criminal record in the United States, for example, is grounds for exclusion. So recently there was a case where Code Pink, the women who protest in Washington and all over the U.S. have criminal charges against them for trespassing or something. And it's a protest-related mm-hmm. charge, and now Canada is saying that they can't enter Canada. I think that's mm-hmm. been resolved at this point, but could you talk a little bit about how other countries are responding to the U.S.'s crackdown on their citizens also being able to move, if that's something your project has addressed?
Well, maybe I'll approach it from a different angle than the one you proposed. I mean... It's an interesting. There's clearly an interesting connection between penal systems and migrant detention.
Mm-hmm.
They have a very similar base, right? Which is effectively removing from the populace a certain group of people for certain reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So on a very base level, and so they're locked up, they're deprived of their liberty, and all the sort of bells and whistles are the same: bars, guards, barbed wire,
mm-hmm.
Prison regimes.
Mm-hmm.
So on that really base level, it's in some ways the same sort of thing, but pretty quickly they diverge. In the United States, I know you want me to talk about other countries, and I will in just a moment, but in the United States, the relationship between immigration detention and the penal system is very tight because the United States makes such wide use of prisons for detaining immigrants,
okay.
for detaining undocumented. So that's the strongest connection. But generally speaking,
mm-hmm.
anywhere you look across the globe, from country to country to country, the law and order, the police, the authorities, the officials that are involved in policing criminality are not involved in, or at least should not be involved, according to the law, in detaining undocumented immigrants or people
mm-hmm.
for migration-related reasons. Most countries say very specifically in the books that the people who can detain people for the purposes of deportation are only immigration authorities.
Okay.
Okay. So that I think pretty broadly you'll see that distinction.
Okay.
However, having said that, the law may say one thing, but in practice, This is not what happens. I mean, I've already given you the case of South Africa, where the police in South Africa, the police do not have the authority to detain people for purposes of deportation. But there they are on the border, running this detention center, and the Department of Home Affairs in South Africa has nothing to do with it, and actually does not even have staff on site.
Mm-hmm.
Reporting from Mexico. I mean, it's amazing how many times you hear that it's the police service that are rounding up immigrants.
Okay.
And detaining them. So the fact that you have, I mean, anytime you have this situation of deprivation of liberty, it's going to quickly, even though the law may say that it should be distinct, it can quickly sort of become folded into the process of criminal law and order.
Okay.
And you see that across the board. So I hope that sort of answers your question.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's very difficult to talk about these things that are so specifically related to the particular legal and policy context at a global level, because it immediately sort of dissolves into generalities.
Yeah.
So.
No, but there are these generalities. They're there. You see them. They're patterns. I mean, like, for instance, this issue of how laws in the books typically say the only people who can deport these people are immigration authorities.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty clear pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Even if in actual practice, things can be quite different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What does the future hold in store for the Global Detention Project?
What we need to do is get all our data online.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of manpower. It takes a lot of people working
mm-hmm.
on that
mm-hmm.
to get that to happen, because we're creating maps, we're creating databases, we're creating text, and so it's pretty laborious. So the first thing we need to do is get all our data online, and to do that, we have maps right now, we have lists, but we have a huge database that we want to make interactive with the website, so that every country
mm-hmm.
and all the data we have, and every time we change that or update that data on the database itself, it'll change on the website. So that's one thing we want to do this year, have done before the end of this year. In addition, we want to begin publishing yearly reports,
okay.
the state of migration detention in the world. And we hope to do that the first time this year, covering about 75 different countries, where we describe in detail. We categorize, we encode in detail different detention sites in different countries and describe a bit of the context, the policy context for this sort of detention. And that would become a yearly publication if we can keep this project going. So, but what we would like to do is eventually develop a sort of best practices where by having all of this comparative data from country to country to country, you can really begin to come up with very hard and fast ideas on best practices across
mm-hmm.
multiple examples. We would love to develop a collaboration. There's a group out there that's been called the International Detention Coalition, which has members in several dozen countries around the world. They're doing great work on building communication and lines of collaboration between
mm-hmm.
on-the-ground NGOs throughout the world. And we would love to develop a stronger collaboration with them. Because we're researchers sitting in offices in Geneva. These are people on the ground who
right.
really work with these centers on a daily basis. Being able to tap into that source of information, as
mm-hmm.
it were, and provide something of our own to them, you know. So to develop a relationship with them, I think, would be a really would be a nice and sort of unique collaboration between academia and advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
Just talking off the top of my head, those are some of the things that I hope to develop in coming years.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Michael Flynn, founder and lead researcher of the Global Detention Project at the Graduate Institute for the Study of Global Migration in Geneva, Switzerland. You can learn more about migration-related detention at www.globaldetentionproject.org.